Azar al-Saidi has been repeatedly fired on by the Zionist regime. Following one such episode of state violence in 2017, Khazar was arrested and detained for almost a year. He was accused of crossing the permitted fishing boundary off Gaza's coastline, a boundary that is often arbitrary. In February 2019, Khazar was out fishing with his cousin, Mohammad, when they were attacked by the Zionist regime's navy. The two men tried to escape, but could not. The Zionist regime's navy fired an estimated 30 rubber-coated steel bullets at Khazar, while his cousin managed to hunker down. After being struck in both eyes, Khazar fell over and lost consciousness. "I woke up 4 days later in an Israeli hospital in Ashdod," he said, adding, "I heard someone speaking Hebrew and asked him, 'Where am I?' But he didn't answer." A doctor who spoke Arabic then explained to Khazar that he had lost sight in his right eye. His left eye could take about a week to recover, the doctor predicted. Despite being in severe pain, Khazar was shackled by hand and feet as troops brought him to the Erez military checkpoint, which separates Gaza and the occupied territories. He was escorted through the checkpoint and abandoned by the Zionist regime troops. A man came to assist him and brought him to the local police, who called an ambulance. When Khazar was examined by doctors in Gaza, they confirmed that he was now blind in both eyes. "Today, Khazar seldom leaves his home," he said. "I don't have any desire to meet anyone." Opening fire is not the only way that the Zionist regime undermines the safety of Gaza's fishers. The relentless siege on Gaza has caused living standards to decline generally, and particularly among fishers. Many fishers cannot foot the bill for maintenance work on their vessels. The Zionist regime's import restrictions have also led to a shortage of spare parts. The shortage means that when spare parts are available to buy, they are more expensive than they were previously. According to one man who carries out repair work on Gaza's boats, the price of a new engine for a medium-sized vessel is now more than $11,000, almost twice what it was a decade ago. The consequence of working in boats that are not seaworthy can prove fatal, as the story of Muhammad Musleh illustrates. Muhammad, 40, drowned in September when the boat in which he was fishing capsized. Its engine had ceased to function. His brother, Allah, admitted that the boat was not in good condition, but the family had to keep using it for reasons of economic necessity. Allah said, "If we had had money to buy another engine, we wouldn't have lost Muhammad. But we couldn't afford a new one, and we still can't. I know it was wrong for us to go out to sea," he said, "but we didn't have another choice. I am a father of four. Faiz, another brother, is a father of three, and Muhammad was also a father of four. Who else will feed our children?"
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is for a better life.
Farmud ba'istu lu'utammim makarim al-akhlaq.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to For a Better Life. I am going to speak about hypocrisy in this episode. Hypocrisy is undoubtedly one of the most detestable qualities. It is one of the most despicable and disgusting qualities. Hypocrisy has been sometimes translated or replaced with double standards. But of course, these are two different words that can be used in their different contexts. Hypocrisy is something evil. We come across people who have this, unfortunately, this evil habit and this evil trait. Such people are disliked, such people are despised and detested in public. Let me say one thing, and when it comes to the attribute of hypocrisy, it's an evil attribute. It is in man's nature to accept happiness and freedom and to upgrade itself to the highest degree of dignity. Yet, when man becomes polluted with lying, with violation of promises and breaching of agreements, hypocrisy finds itself a wide arena and is ready to penetrate such polluted natures. It's a very good thing to understand that in the absence of noble traits, it is the hypocrisy that finds its way into one's life. Hypocrisy advances in these circumstances until it eventually becomes an acute disease. Hypocrisy is not something that can be said that it was achieved or it was something person was born with. It is something that man can probably acquire in the absence of noble moral traits. Hypocrisy advances and penetrates into one's life in the absence of noble traits.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can listen to us at parstoday.com/en.
Hypocrisy not only prevents individuals from reaching the truth or even attempting to discover the truth, but it also becomes an indestructible dam placed on the path of acquiring noble characteristics. It's a big hindrance. It forms, in fact, an impediment preventing the individual from moving on, from acquiring, from achieving noble characteristics and noble traits. So it's a great hurdle. Of course, all that stands in the path of sensible conduct and all that stands in the path of psychological integrity and contradicts the life of happiness can be eradicated and can be destroyed if a person himself decides to do so, if a person makes up his mind. It is all depends on the individual himself as to when he makes up his mind to fight hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is a dangerous epidemic which threatens a man's honor and threatens man's dignity, because it leads to irresponsibility, it leads to lowly traits, it leads to misery, it leads to a lot of evils. It's beyond my ability to enumerate the negative consequences and the impacts that it may have on the individual himself and on his relationship with other people. Because hypocrisy replaces the individual's self-confidence with suspicion, with pessimism and anxiety. And these are the consequences of hypocrisy. Those who are hypocrite, they cease to have any kind of trust. They will no longer be trusted by people around him. and no one is ready to interact with such people who are hypocrites. And those who reach this dangerous point in their behavioral misconduct convince themselves that they want the best for all people. And when this troubled person, you can call him hypocrite, deals with an unharmonious couple, such people presents themselves as dear friends, as faithful advisor, and they present themselves as people who are good, as people who can be trusted, because they wear such face and they wear such things. They pretend to be such thing. But in reality, in the heart of heart, they have the evil intention. That's the reason why they are not trusted in the society. That's the reason people stay away from such people. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Welcome to your program For a Better Life. One of the great scholars has said that enemies have the characteristics of being both coward and overt enemies. For animosity have just one color. I wish that friends were like enemies as far as pretense is concerned. Undoubtedly, friends that are hypocrites are worse than the common hypocrite. So, this is what he says. And he says this because the hypocrites are unable to win the hearts of those who he deals with. And he is unable to gain love and respect. His life is full of humiliation and disgust. His attempts to conceal the facts prevent him from living a secure, stable, and confident and anxiety-free life. He is in constant fear of the inevitable discovery of what he really is. So that is what a hypocrite is. Of course, there's more to say about hypocrites, but time is over. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
My brother sitting in despair, you can make a change in a world where no one cares. My brother, you can light the way, can be the promise for better and brighter days. My brother, let's make a vow today. We will keep on trying until our final day. We are a people strong with a vision so sincere. Our faith will carry a message loud and clear. Islam, the canopy, sheltering over land, uniting one another, together hand in hand.
In the limelight.
Loyalists of former President Donald Trump attempt to certify the Electoral College in favor of the defeated candidate with forged documents, according to a new reporting by MSNBC host Rachel Maddow. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Chris Walker, journalist. This article is published under the heading Republicans in Five States Forged Electoral College Documents, MSNBC host says. Stay tuned for more. Loyalists of former President Donald Trump attempt to certify the Electoral College in favor of the defeated candidate with forged documents, according to new reporting by MSNBC host Rachel Maddow. Trump loyalists forged documents in at least five states where Joe Biden had defeated Trump and submitted them for certification, according to Maddow. The forgeries do not look like the uniquely printed paperwork that a state submits, Maddow noted, but they used very specific language purporting that those who signed it were the duly elected and qualified electors for President and Vice President of the United States of America, even though they were not. It's not like they created these documents to, like, hold close to their chest and fantasize that this had been the real outcome, Maddow said. It's not like they created these documents just to keep for themselves as keepsakes. They sent them into the government as if they were real documents. Maddow also said that the effort to flip the election in Trump's favor appeared to be coordinated. The fake documents all match exactly, Maddow observed. Same formatting, same font, same spacing, almost the exact same wording, all of them. Later in the program, the MSNBC host connected these documents to a draft letter written by a Department of Justice official loyal to Trump named Jeffrey Clark, which explicitly describes these forged slates of electors from multiple states as part of a plan to keep the former president in office. It was unusual, Maddow said, that Clark was aware that these states had made these types of moves before he suggested the idea to Trump and his allies. Maddow asked, how did Clark know that 2 weeks earlier, Republicans in at least five states had in fact created these forged electoral documents? Did the Trump Justice Department know about it because they helped Republicans in those states do it? We don't know, but somebody helped them do it because they all filed the exact same documents. Other documents unearthed in the past year have detailed similar strategies designed by Trump allies to overturn the election. In one such document, Trump's former lawyer, John Eastman, devised a six-point plan that relied upon multiple slates of electors being used to create confusion in the Electoral College certification process. Former Vice President Mike Pence could then use that confusion to force a vote in the House of Representatives, where Trump would then win the presidency, Eastman said. Weeks after the election was called for Biden, Trump aide Stephen Miller also said in December that the campaign's next step to challenging the election's outcome was to submit false certificates of ascertainment, stating that Trump won in states where he didn't. An alternate slate of electors in contested states is going to vote, and we are going to send those results up to Congress, Miller said at the time, adding, this will ensure that all of our legal remedies remain open. That means if we win these cases in the courts, that we can direct the alternate slate of electors be certified.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
Humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in al-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi as-salam, and especially the justice of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salamullah. Amir al-Mu'mineen assessed things correctly and engaged himself in his task to achieve human rights and to achieve justice. Fearlessly, according to his calculation, of course. He never entertained any doubt with regard to anything related to public affairs, which many of those were before him and after him. Not only did they entertain the idea, but they enforced it on the outside that the public welfare should be under the service. People should serve them, and whatever they own is theirs, you know, belong to the rulers, not to people. Where Amir al-Mu'mineen, no, that wasn't him. As and when any officer or governor oppressed the subject, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam neither sits quiet nor confide at their actions. When he sees people doing the wrong thing, especially governors, those who are in power, he doesn't say, well, it's not my business, or he comes with them, you know, because they are the rulers. No, he never displayed slackness when he found that some person had formed a group against the true government. At times, his plan to achieve his ends were opposed not only to the wishes of the enemies, but to those of his friends as well. But he did not mind this at all. He said, مَا تَرَكَ لَيِ الْحَقُّ مِنْ صَدِيقٍ. The truth has left me no friends at all. All this was done by him so that the right of every person to lead a peaceful life might be ensured. Because Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when he was trying to apply his own government, groups were formed against him. Wars were raised against him, even by the wife of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam herself in the Battle of Kamal, And then you have Safin with Muawiyah. Then you have Nahrawan. And then you have, you know, all these battles were only raised because Ali was establishing a system of justice. In the Kamal, Aisha came to him seeking inheritance. And he says to her, well, we don't have such a thing. because you guys denied Fatima her inheritance. I only give you your right. I'm not going to give you more. Talha was Zubair wanted to have position. Amir al-Mu'minin said, we don't have such a system. We only give position to those who are worthy and fit. Thus, you have the Jamal. When Muawiyah refused to step down from the government position that was given to him forcefully by one of the previous so-called khalifs, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi had to go to war against him, because Amir al-Mu'minin wanted to achieve a human right. He wanted to achieve justice. He wanted people to live in peace, to live in prosperity. And as long as there's a tyrant taking that from them, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi was not going to sit quietly nor connive with their action. Therefore, he had to do what needs to be done. Let us take a break and then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he had a clear understanding of how dangerous things will be and how people were divided into two classes, and to prefer one of them to the other. This will retard the intellect, create malice in the spirits, and introduce oppression and injustice in the judgment and in the transactions, and all sorts of mischiefs and corruption will appear. So he was put in an environment where he had these two groups, and these two groups were divided, those who seek justice and those who seek corruption. And Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi understood how dangerous the situation is and how sensitive it is. The result will be that ambition for life will die, and that people will become pessimistic and will entertain ill will towards one another. Consequently, consequently, society will be ruined. So long as these two classes exist in a society, a conflict between them is inevitable, and it will involve the losses of many lives, as we saw in the battles between Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam and those before him. So Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, he tried his best in establishing justice and equality amongst people, is to eliminate these two classes and have one class, just one piece of Islam. Or even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, وَاَعْتَصُمُوا بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ جَمِيعًا وَلَا تَفَرَّقُوا. Hold on to the rope of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and do not be divided. As long as there are groups within one faith, within one religion, then surely rights will be taken. Surely people will be killed. It happened at the time of Amir al-Mu'minin before him and continued until our modern day today, where you see one group who claims to be Muslims are killing, blowing themselves up in another group who are also Muslims. And you got to ask yourself, what happened, what went wrong? So Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, and during his time, he made it his mission to eliminate the classes, and he understood the dangers of it, and he understood exactly the cost he has to pay, which is his life. But did that stop Amir al-Mu'minin from trying to seek and achieve his aim and his goal? Of course it didn't. If it meant that Ali alayhi salam killed in his prostration in the Masjid of Kufa for trying to uphold justice, peace, and equality for mankind, so be it. That's the price he gave, and that's the price that me and you have to hold at a high regard. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. 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 Salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Arab intellectuals and ordinary people are still angry over UAE's normalization of ties with Israel. A number of intellectuals from Persian Gulf Arab states have announced that they will boycott a literature festival that is set to take place in Abu Dhabi in February. Omani writer Bushra Khalfan and Kuwaiti writers Mona Al-Shamri, Ahmed Al-Zamam and Ali Ashur decided to boycott the Emirates Airlines Festival of Literature.
Yeah, I guess this development indeed shows that there is a large number of people who disapprove. And that has been the case all along, because we need to keep in mind that these regimes are not elected by their population, and they don't necessarily make decisions on behalf of the population in these countries.
The intellectuals have cited UAE's normalization of ties with Israel for the decision to boycott the event. The list of invitees included writers, academics, and intellectuals from a number of Arab countries. Other writers from Persian Gulf countries have also been called to withdraw from the event. The festival will take place from February the 3rd to 13th at its new venue for 2022. UAE's image has been tarnished amongst Arab intellectuals and ordinary people for its decision to normalize ties. Palestinians have described the move as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
And of course, the public communication and freedom of speech is very strongly restricted in the UAE, which means that public dissent And in this case, and of course, public expressions against the normalization with the Israeli regime, of course, can lead to consequences for the populations.
The United Arab Emirates is amongst a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States in 2020. The Emiratis opened their embassy in Israel in July 2021. Israel has also opened an embassy in the Emirates capital, Abu Dhabi, and the consulate in the UAE business hub, Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals ranging from financial services to tourism. And in December, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett visited the UAE to further deepen the ties between the two regimes. The UAE was not the only country to normalize its ties with Israel. Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco have also established diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already vowed to help Israel normalize relations with additional countries in the Muslim and Arab worlds. Blinken said the Biden administration would continue to build on the successful efforts of the last administration to keep normalization marching forward.
Well, the Israeli colony is in many ways a proxy and a military base for the United States, and it helps secure the U.S. role in Western Asia and beyond. So, of course, the Israeli regime is of essential importance for the United States, and expanding Israel's ties to the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and then potentially other governments and regimes in the region is, of course, of central interest because Israel is central for the military-industrial complex.
Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stance adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back.
Now, as a result, of course, the Palestinian struggle has not been of any importance, or has even rather become an obstacle for many of these regimes. But at the same time, of course, it does not reflect necessarily the popular mood in these places, where many people are, of course, pro-Palestinian, to support the liberation of Palestine.
Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel.
Earlier this month, in his New Year message, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un pledged once again to boost Pyongyang's defenses. He said North Korea would continue to bolster its military capabilities because the peninsula still faces an increasingly unstable military environment. And now Kim seems determined to fulfill that pledge. This week he oversaw a hypersonic missile test. North Korean media said the projectile launched on Tuesday successfully made a turn before destroying its target 1,000 kilometers away. It was North Korea's third test of such a missile. South Korea's military acknowledged that the latest missile launch demonstrated quote-unquote improvement from previous tests. The North seems resolute on its path to master the new technology. Unlike ballistic missiles that fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory, hypersonic weapons fly at lower altitudes, making them less vulnerable to interception. The main feature of hypersonic weapons is their maneuverability, which makes them much harder to detect by radar. North Korea is now undoubtedly among a small number of countries, including the United States, racing to develop hypersonic weapons. The United States and some of its allies were quick to condemn the North's latest test. The U.S. did not stop there. It later announced sanctions against a number of individuals for their alleged roles in producing goods for Pyongyang's weapons program. The U.S. administration said the measures are aimed at preventing the advancement of North Korea's military programs and to block its attempts to develop weapons technologies. The sanctions imposed by the U.S. Treasury freeze all U.S. assets of those who are targeted and generally bans Americans from doing any business with them. Can such measures put obstacles in the way of North Korea's development of advanced weapons? Past experience shows that's highly unlikely because Pyongyang has been subjected to Western sanctions for many years. It has suffered under sanctions, but it has somehow managed to withstand the American pressure campaign.
Those sanctions continue to implement not just food, but also medicine, technology, equipment to make life impossible for the people of the DPRK, just as they're doing in Iran, just as they're doing in Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. But I think that these sanctions are not going to have much of an effect any longer, because we have to remember that the era of U.S. dominance, of the single dominance hegemony of the U.S. is over.
Despite its long list of economic problems, the North has managed to produce several nuclear warheads, describing them as a necessary insurance against an attack by the U.S. The North seems to deeply distrust America. Under former U.S. President Donald Trump, America and North Korea came close to a conflict before a series of meetings between the two adversaries. The high-profile summits broke down with no agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden insists that it is open to dialogue with North Korea. But Pyongyang seems to have learned a lesson from Trump's era and his futile attempts at detente.
I think the Biden administration, while in appearance it may seem that it's more progressive or more prone to dialogue, in reality it is very much achieving the same goals as Trump and the Republican strategy in general against the DPRK, which is regime change.
Pyongyang has described American diplomatic overtures as empty rhetoric without meaningful changes to hostile policies, including war games close to its borders and economic sanctions. The latest American sanctions are expected to further complicate the situation.
As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The kingdom, which relies almost entirely on foreign-made weapons in the war, is said to be running low on interceptor missiles. An American official tells Financial Times that Riyadh may have only months until it runs out of missiles for its U.S.-made Patriot missile systems. According to the official, the kingdom has asked its allies for loans and pleaded with the U.S. to replenish its stock. Almost 7 years after the Yemen war started, cracks are now showing in Saudi Arabia's military campaign against Yemen. On Saturday, the Saudi-led coalition played footage during a press conference that purportedly showed ballistic missiles stored at Yemen's vital Hodeidah port. The coalition's spokesperson, Turki al-Maliki, said the footage means Hodeidah and Salif ports are legitimate targets since they're being used as military bases. The Yemenis, however, were quick to identify the footage. They say it's taken from an American documentary film about Iraq and has nothing to do with Yemen.
If you go to Al Arabiya, they claim that the Saudis just had major military victories against the Yemenis, who they call Houthis, and a victory is within strike. It's like watching a bad production of 1984, really, what comes out of the telescreen, constant victories, or the TV news in the 60s in the United States during the Vietnam War.
In response, the Yemeni Foreign Ministry said the coalition's pretexts for targeting the country's ports are mere theatrical posturing and aimed at legitimizing the aggression.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The U.S. president made the pledge back in February last year. He touted the move as part of efforts to restore an emphasis on human rights. Biden, however, said Washington will continue to support and help Riyadh.
The peace activists who hailed his announcement are now dismayed at his administration for going back on the promise. Back in September, the U.S. State Department approved its first major arms sale to the kingdom under President Biden, with a sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued at up to $650 million. A State Department spokesperson defended the sale as, quote, fully consistent with the administration's pledge to lead with diplomacy to end the conflict in Yemen.
Biden administration had actually run on a promise to put an end to the war in Yemen. You could actually do that in a heartbeat by grounding the AWACS that support the Saudi airstrikes against Yemen. Those are entirely within the control of the Pentagon, and Biden is the commander-in-chief. So if he ordered no support for the bombing raids, AWACS and other guidance information, then that would be the end of the war.
President Biden has broken another promise about defending humanitarian rights, an issue he staked much of his presidency on. Back in February, a declassified U.S. intelligence report concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman authorized a team of Saudi security and intelligence officials to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But Biden later decided not to punish bin Salman, saying it would be diplomatically unprecedented for the United States. Before he took office, though, the U.S. was considering removing four batteries of the Patriot missile system from the Saudi oil facilities.
They've been encircling Russia and China pretty much since this end of the Second World War, and they are now pretty much up at the borders around both of them with more military assets than have ever existed before. Some of these assets in other parts of the world, including the 30 or 40,000 troops that have been deployed out of the Middle East, are most likely being focused on China.
As Washington's focus changes from West Asia to Eurasia, what will happen to its regional allies like Riyadh? The U.S. takes in stride the violations perpetrated by its allies while accusing countries it deems its adversaries of the same charges. Wouldn't that embolden those officials to commit even worse crimes, knowing that they can get away with murder in the most literal sense?
Escalating tensions between Moscow and Western countries, namely the United States, in recent months have prompted security talks over issues straining bilateral relations. Russian and American diplomats meet for talks in the Swiss city of Geneva. The talks are aimed at a wide-ranging new security arrangement between Russia and the West. The Kremlin demands guarantees that NATO will not expand further eastward by granting membership to ex-Soviet Ukraine. The U.S.-led NATO military alliance claims Moscow is building up troops on its border with the intention to attack Ukraine. Moscow denies the allegations, emphasizing that it can move its troops around within its own borders as it sees fit. On the other hand, Russia has long complained about existing U.S. missile defense capabilities based in southern Romania. Also, a second installation in northern Poland is nearly complete and projected to be operational by the end of this year. Moscow has recently voiced concerns that Washington would also seek to base missiles in Ukraine, which could be used for offensive purposes as well.
There was always a threat to Russia. NATO has traditionally, more specifically during the last few years, had a very hostile attitude towards Russia, and therefore they felt justifiably threatened.
The situation prompted Moscow to table a set of security proposals, which included curbs on NATO expansion and security guarantees for Russia. Some of these demands have already been rejected by the U.S. and its allies, as both NATO and Washington have said that the alliance would never promise not to expand. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov held a meeting with his American counterpart, Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman, in Geneva on Sunday. He described the initial talks with Washington and security guarantees as stunning, but also noted that the conversation was difficult. Russia rules out any concession at security talks with the U.S., warning that the talks on the Ukraine crisis might end early. Meanwhile, the U.S. says no breakthroughs are expected and that progress depends on de-escalation from Moscow. The Russians are also scheduled to hold similar high-level discussions with NATO and Europeans. In December, Moscow set out its security demands in two documents, a proposed treaty with the US and an agreement with NATO. Essentially, Russia now wants guarantees that NATO will halt its eastward expansion, rule out membership for Ukraine and other former Soviet countries, and roll back its military deployments in Central and Eastern Europe. The US and its NATO allies, meanwhile, have already said they will not accede to Russia's demands. They have already rejected a demand for the removal of all US nuclear weapons stationed in Europe, and also flatly ruled out Moscow's demand for a guarantee that Ukraine and Georgia will never join NATO. Russia considers this expansion as a direct threat to its national security. Also, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says the alliance and Russia could still find a political solution for their differences. Stoltenberg reiterated the alliance wasn't ready to discuss guarantees that it won't expand eastward to meet Moscow's demands, saying that would breach NATO's core principles. But he said the US and NATO were prepared to speak about possible risk reduction measures like arms control, on efforts to try to have more transparency on military activity, exercises, and also on lines of communications.
Western forces puts NATO on the border of Russia, and this is what is creating the danger. This is really the only thing that is creating the danger, and to a large extent, Russian actions have been a reaction against the more hostile and the more aggressive policy of NATO in expanding and in meeting the demands of even the smaller countries who are really obsessed with Russia at the cost of agreements and comity between Russia and NATO.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has previously warned that Moscow will act if the US-led NATO military alliance crosses its red lines in Ukraine. Putin said the expansion of NATO military infrastructure in Ukraine was a red line he hoped would not be crossed.
In the limelight.
After raking in enormous profits from its coronavirus vaccine in 2021, the US-based pharmaceutical giant Pfizer has kicked off the new year by hiking the prices of more than 120 of its drugs, resulting in significantly higher costs for patients amid a deadly pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, After Year of Vaccine Profiteering, Pfizer Hikes Prices on 125 Drugs. Stay tuned for more. After raking in enormous profits from its coronavirus vaccine in 2021, the US-based pharmaceutical giant Pfizer has kicked off the new year by hiking the prices of more than 120 of its drugs, resulting in significantly higher costs for patients amid a deadly pandemic. That's according to a new report released recently by Patients for Affordable Drugs, P4AD. Which found that pharmaceutical companies have raised the prices of 554 medicines this month alone. Pfizer led the way with 125 price hikes to start 2022, leading P4AD to label the company the industry's poster child for greed. Due to sales of its COVID-19 vaccine, which is said to be the best-selling drug of all time, Pfizer shattered profits records in 2021, Projected sales for 2022 are $54.5 billion, more than double the previous record for one-year sales for a prescription drug, the report notes. To put this into perspective, AbbVie's Humira previously held the spot with $19.8 billion in sales, and Pfizer's best-selling product just prior to the pandemic achieved worldwide revenues of $5.8 billion. Despite this record revenue in 2021, the report continues, Pfizer began 2022 with price hikes on 7 of its 10 best-selling drugs, including its pneumonia vaccine, up 6.9%, a breast cancer medication up 6.9%, and a treatment for people with cardiovascular disease up 6%. P480 notes these hikes of 5% or 6% can translate into thousands of dollars in higher costs for patients. Ashley Suter, a West Virginia resident who takes Pfizer's Eliquis to manage her autoimmune disease, told P4A that she has had to spend her entire paycheck on medication and will likely be taking Eliquis for the rest of her life. Suter said, "With the price increasing again, I worry about how I will make ends meet while still affording my drugs." While the worst offenders, Pfizer and its subsidiaries, were hardly alone in raising drug costs for patients during the first month of 2022, according to P4AD, which also spotlighted price hikes by Gilead, Eli Lilly, and other prominent pharmaceutical companies. So far in 2022, the group noted in a press release, drug companies have increased prices on 554 drugs. 183 drugs were hiked by $100 or more, and 118 drugs with increases carry a price over $5,000. The average price hike was 6.3%, and one in four price hikes exceeded the most recently available inflation rate at the time of analysis. David Mitchell, P4AD's founder and a blood cancer patient whose medications have a list price of more than $900,000 annually, said in a statement recently that even as we enter the third year of a pandemic, Big Pharma continues its practice of targeting American patients and consumers with price increases. Completely undeterred by the financial and health challenges facing American families. Mitchell added, drug corporations can do this because we let them, unlike other nations that use their purchasing power to get a better deal. The Build Back Better Act, Democrats' $1.75 trillion reconciliation package, includes provisions that would let Medicare negotiate the prices of a limited subset of prescription drugs directly with pharmaceutical corporations, something it is currently barred from doing by law. A prohibition that has contributed to sky-high medicine costs in the U.S. Democrats' legislation would also penalize drug companies that hike prices faster than the rate of inflation, which is currently at a 40-year high. But the House-passed bill remains stuck in the Senate as Senator Joe Manchin demands the removal of key Democratic priorities, including the expanded child tax credit and investments in affordable housing. Democrats are expected to continue working to advance the legislation in the coming days. Mitchell recently said, The drug pricing legislation agreed to in the Build Back Better Act would curb rising drug prices for millions of patients and halt abusive annual price hikes by limiting increases to the rate of inflation, which is projected to return to 2.3% in 2023. The Senate must pass this legislation immediately, he said.